email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Right, so 5 on 5 5 on ray@rte.ie. I'm not as well as I thought I was. That's the name of the latest book from Ruby Wax, who you will have heard there in the background. Ruby's in a studio in London. Good afternoon, Ruby.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi. And you're coming to Ireland to discuss your book in October. So we'll tell people about that.
You have a little time. You could kind of crawl to the bookshop if you start now.
They'll definitely have read it by then, you would hope.
Yeah.
So it's Thursday, October 17th, Everyman in Cork, Theatre Royal in Waterford. The next day on the 19th is the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, the Mac in Belfast on Sunday, October 20th, and then you're back down to the Galway Comedy Festival in the Town Hall, Tuesday, October 22nd. And it's the book, I'm Not As Well As I Thought I Was. Yes, it's a book, but it's a show about a book.
It's well, there's a book, but yes. Then the show is a play.
Oh,
and
right.
it's not similar to the book. It's a performance, and it, you know, some people just read their book and they're really lazy.
Yes.
Well, I don't. This is it's a theatrical event. That's all I'm saying.
Wow, I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
I'm going to go.
You'll be coming.
Yes, I will. So when you set out to write this book, what was the intention?
Well, the intention was I was sort of trying to get money out of the publisher. So I said, I'm going to write a book where I go around the world or go, you know, to epic journeys to find meaning. Now, I didn't know what that meant, but they fell for it.
Right.
So they paid for that. So I did go on these epic journeys. I swam with whales that were migrating. I went on a 30-day silent retreat.
Yeah.
I tried to get people out of Afghanistan. Mm. I lived in a Christian monastery. I wrote it up and it was very much like, you know, Adrian Gill.
Yes.
The late Adrian Gill.
Yeah.
Or Dave Barry, you know, or Bill Bryson.
Yes, the famous travel writers. Yeah.
That's kind of what it was, except maybe I'm not as good. Okay, I'm just throwing that up in the air. But it was funny and it was dark and it was blah. But my girlfriend said it's just a travel book. And, you know, so I realized that too. And then what happened was, now it has nothing to do with it, or maybe it does, but I'm not putting it out there. I ended up in a mental institution.
Yeah.
Not a joke. It did happen. I hadn't had depression for 12 years, but it came shortly after the Christian monastery. And so they said, you have to have therapy, and I don't do therapy. Because they said, you have a trauma. And I said, trauma's an Oprah word. I don't do trauma.
Okay.
But they had somebody work with me. And a specialist, EMDR specialist. It's the way to deal with trauma. And she made me tell my story, you know, or work with me. But she said, you can't be funny, because I'd made my family life hilarious. Mm. I mean, that's how I was my comedy material.
Yeah.
Because my parents were so warped that I didn't even have to edit it. It just went straight on the page. And Carrie Fisher edited my first book and said my family were almost as nuts as hers, which is the best review you could ever
praise.
Get.
Yeah.
High praise. High praise.
Hold on. You've nearly, that's it. We're finished there. You've said it all there, but we need to, you know, go over it and get the details.
Let me finish.
Go on. Okay.
Oh my God. I'm just trying to get to the end, but I went off piece. So you have to say, Ruby, come back.
Right. Come back, Ruby. Come back.
Yes, okay. So what happened was I had to work with a therapist and she took me down. And so the journey became internal instead of this running away.
Yeah.
And I found out, which I wasn't aware of, that I was locked in my house where I grew up in Evanston. Not locked, literally. I went to school and I was allowed to see certain people, but everything was checked. You know, they were refugees. They brought the war from Europe into our kitchen in Evanston. But I guess they were fearful. And I didn't realize it wasn't normal to not leave your house. So it becomes a journey of somebody who's running away, but not running toward anything, just trying to get out of a fantasy house.
Yeah,
it was haunted.
There's a lot happening in the book. So I suppose we start at the beginning with your parents. And they, as you say, refugees fled Europe during the Second World War. They were Jews. And they brought the trauma, I suppose, if you don't mind me using the word, with them.
Well, now I can be booked on Oprah because I am fully traumatized.
Right. I shouldn't laugh, but you beg that reaction from people, literally and metaphorically. So your parents, although it might sound like an act of love to protect you from the bad world, you know, in the book, they come across as not nice people at all. Your dad called you pathetic. He called you a loser. Your mother seemed self-obsessed, narcissistic. And you were in the middle of all that.
Did I make them seem that way?
Yes.
Yeah, that's because they were that way.
Oh, right. Okay, right.
You know that thing called writing?
Yes, I know. Yeah. But
they were that way.
But yet, and this is the odd thing about being a human being, you craved affirmation from them. You craved approval, did you?
Well, I think that all kids who grow up with, you know, narcissistic parents want to get in the headlights somewhere. You know, they wanted me to be a reflection of who they were, but I ended up, they loved me until I could speak. And then I was a great disappointment. Also, she was beautiful and I wasn't. So I was a disappointment. And so you want to prove, I spent my life seeking revenge. And I said to certain people, I've said before, you could end up either a serial killer or a comedian. Mm. And I could have done the double whopper because I was turned in by one of my teachers and said that I reminded her of there were some famous murderers around at the time, the Mendoza brothers,
right, yeah.
Except just me, because I had that killer tendency. But then I turned it into comedy.
Mm.
And that's, I think, a little bit of what comedy is sometimes. It's machine gun fire.
Yeah. And I suppose you're not afraid to go places that other people are afraid to go. You generally, and comedians sometimes. So just tell us a little bit about your father and your mother then, because can you see it at a distance now that maybe they were suffering from trauma as well, and there's this cycle, isn't there, across generations?
Well, I guess there's epigenetics,
yes.
You know, that you pass
yes.
on the genes of, because I can't watch any films about World War II, because I feel like it's living in my head.
Mm.
I don't even need the information. I know that, but they never mentioned I had any relatives in Austria. So imagine my surprise when they did, who do you think
yes.
you are? And I meet one after another, don't meet them, they're dead, but I find out one after another of my relatives on my mother's side were all in insane asylums.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a coincidence why I was so interested in mental illness, even as a kid of 12. I used to steal books from the library about mental illness. So that, thus my fascination.
And but, Ruby, is that why you balked at the word trauma a bit? Because you were sort of sure when you did Who Do You Think You Are, spotting the genes, that it was hereditary and not, nothing to do with, you know, the nature side.
But the
it
word
was
trauma.
Nature, not nurture. Yeah.
Yeah, but the word trauma is, you know, it's a word du jour. You know, it's like but now people are talking about probiotics. I just hate when I don't want to jump on a bandwagon.
No.
But say, for example, I'm legitimately trauma. Everybody else is making it up.
Okay. Right. So let's find out how you accepted the word trauma then. So you were doing all this for a book and you were in Spirit Rock doing mindfulness. You were swimming with whales. You went to a monastery. You were in refugee camps and all of that. And then at the end of it, you felt depression coming on. What was that like? Because you'd been severely depressed back about, 12 years ago. So
yeah,
go on.
Yeah. No, it's a feeling that you can't, now because I do mindfulness, I only practice mindfulness so I can see when it's coming, because it's a way of taking your inner temperature rather than, it's like a barometer for your internal landscape rather than just checking the weather. So I can usually catch it coming, and then I'll shut down social media, I'll cut off seeing friends, because I'll know a disease is coming. It's like a tsunami is coming into town. Whereas before, I'd make myself more and more busy to show the world I was fine. And of course, the last thing you are is fine. And then it lasts for months because you're depressed about being depressed. Now I know how to handle it. Mm. I mean, it's still hell, but it doesn't last 5 months. But this time, because I was so busy, I didn't notice. And I should have seen the signs. I didn't get ill because of these journeys. I got ill because, you know, it's that time of the decade. It decides when it's going to hit you, not you deciding when to have it.
Mm, but I'm sure tiredness and stress and all of those things don't help.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
No.
For me, no. I mean, you could be, I've been at the peak of my career in the summer where everything's perfect and you still get it.
All right.
So there's no rhyme or reason. It is like, you know, it's like getting, I don't know, cancer or diabetes or anything.
Okay.
Something goes wrong. So there's a glitch.
So you succumbed.
It's not my fault.
You succumbed to therapy, and also EMDR, which is part of therapy. You can tell us about that. And this other thing, RTMS, which I'd never heard about, which sounds horrific and from a different age, a different century. Tell us about RTMS.
Well, when I got to the clinic, there's a new method of working with people with only depression and OCD. It doesn't work for anything else.
Right.
It looks like a 50s hairdryer,
right.
And it's a clicking, but it bangs the side of your head to kind of recalibrate the neurons. That's the idea. It's not electricity like they used in the days where, you know, you can't remember your planet of origin. They don't use that. They use magnets, so there's no side effects. But it wham, 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 wham. It sounds like a machine gun, and it slightly knocks your head. I mean, I wouldn't say it's delightful, but it's not agonizing. I say, you know, if you've had Botox, it's nothing.
How was it sold to you?
They said you got a 65% chance of recovery. I said, bring it on. And I'd heard of deep brain stimulation. That's been around in America a long time. It's just new in this country.
Right.
And I was one of the people that it worked on. I mean, I was done 3 weeks later.
Wow.
But they don't just give you that. You have to have therapy too.
Yes,
and that's what I was arguing.
And we'll talk about therapy in a moment. But just to go off on a tangent, because there's a lot of talk about hallucinogenic drugs and particularly ayahuasca and how that recalibrates the brain by going on a hallucinogenic trip. And people have used it to treat depression. Have you ever been tempted by that or have you done it?
Well, it's kind of the Wild West.
Mm.
You know, drugs will be the answer, but so far the court is out. I'm sure drugs will be the answer. But you have to use it with a therapist. And also you have to come off of SSRIs, which are antidepressants. So that's kind of a paradox. How are you supposed to take it if you can't take it while you're on antidepressants?
Yeah.
And it's specifically for depressed people, you know, taking these.
And just
like
back to the RTMS, because I know you did the book.
I took all those letters. The MDR, RTMS. Anything in the alphabet I swallowed.
but you hung around with a neuroscientist for a while and you studied how the brain works. And so how does that work? Is it recalibrating the brain in some way? Is it interfering with the synapses or whatever in the brain?
Look, nobody knows.
Oh, they don't know.
Everything's guesswork.
All right, okay.
I mean, they don't know anything. Nobody knows why antidepressants work.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's got a pretty good success rate. If it's banging against your brain and it's got magnets in it,
Sorry, I shouldn't
who knows? Their whole theory is that the neurons are hardwired and they're stuck.
Mm.
So with this banging, they kind of kick them into life again, and then they can make new partners, and you know, jump whatever rut they're in. I'm trying to make it easy. It's way more complicated.
Yeah, but it is about the neuroplasticity of the brain. We used to think that the brain that we were born with was the brain that we died with. Now we know we can change it around.
Shape-shift it.
Yeah. So that's probably part of it.
But, you know, disease is a whole other ball game. If you've got a disease, then good luck.
Mm.
You know, how they heal it is a miracle,
really.
You know, you could believe in God. You could. Nobody knows why anything works. So when they say about antidepressants, tell me how chemo works, you know, and tell me how.
Well, they have an idea.
How radical that is.
They have an idea how it works.
They have an idea, but they're setting a forest on fire when only one tree is sick.
Yeah. Well, they're getting better at that because they can target cancer now with certain certain medicines.
Well, they put all the money in cancer. They didn't put a lot into neuroscience.
Yeah. Do you think they should put more in?
Well, everything comes from the mothership. That's what I always say. Almost every disease is because of too much cortisol. It comes from stress.
Mm.
So what do you think?
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to commit suicide because you had a kidney infection.
No. Yeah. Yeah. If we can control the cortisol in our body, i.e. control the stress that we experience, well, then we're going to be healthier people.
And it's your mind that decides what's stressful. You know, it's not like we're working in coal mines.
Yes. But then we have all that leftover hard wiring from our ancestors who used to run around chasing bison, you know.
Oh, you think it's their fault?
Well, I don't know.
Except they were healthy back then. I know we're not talking about my book and my show, but back in the old days when we were being hunted, you know, once the incident was over and you were either lunch or you were having lunch, and you'd know because you were still in existence. Immediately, the cortisol would stop. Once danger passed, it would stop. We're now living in a world where it never shuts off. Everything is terrifying. Mm.
Do you think they didn't lose sleep back then, back in the cave days?
Did they lose sleep? Were they worried about this? No, nobody died of stress back then. Yeah, they died of old age at about 12 and a half, but nobody died of stress.
Right, back to you.
Oh, back to me.
Yeah. So in your therapy, you talked about, you said it already, being funny, craving a crowd. Three things that were triggers for you: rage, envy, and isolation. And envy comes up over and over again. You're envious of strangers. You're envious of contemporaries. You talk about your envy of Louis.
Tall people.
Sorry, not bald people. I'm a bald person. Sorry. Tall people. Right. Young people, singers, dancers.
Everything.
Yes. How can you stop that? And where did it come from?
Well, again, everything. Well, we're going off piste, and you're making me go off piste because you're asking me these questions. Well, all of these emotions fit perfectly back hundreds of thousands of years. You know, we had to feel shame, guilt, disgust, sadness, rage. You know, but the minute the incident passed, you were back to your homeostatic state. But in this country, in this world, in this culture, we get stuck. You get addicted to rage. You get addicted to, fear. You get addicted to things. Mm. And because in the past, we didn't have this thing called frazzled, which means, that inner monologue that says you're a jerk. Boy, are you asking stupid questions. My answers are ridiculous. Maybe I should pretend I'm somebody else. You know that internal, nagging mother?
Yes. Yeah.
They
yeah.
didn't have that before. They just got on with it.
Right.
So this kind of self-criticism is what's... You know, we're sabotaging ourselves with our own thinking.
Yeah, we've messed things up for ourselves, haven't we?
We did. So let's yearn for the caveman days, because your biggest fear was a saber-toothed tiger.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Oh, my God, I'm a jerk.
That's not going to happen. Yeah, you mentioned a book in your book. Your book is called I'm Not As Well As I Thought I Was, and you're bringing a show, which isn't about the book. It's an independent show to Ireland in October. All of that's factually correct.
Well, it's a relation.
It's a relation.
It's called the same thing.
Yes. But you mentioned Richard Rohr's book, Falling Upward, which I want to talk to you about, because it's about two halves of our lives. Will you tell our listeners about it?
Well, no, in the mental hospital, at the very end, I find one book in there.
Hello?
Is this live?
Yes.
Don't scare me. There was one book in the library. I could do the phone call. It was my daughter. It'd be interesting to hear what she had to say.
Yeah. Put her on.
There was one book, and it was Richard Rohr's book, like you said. And he talks about the first half of your life where you have to develop an ego. You have to create an identity. You're on turbo, and it's not for any reason that the ambition comes and the kind of...
The drive,
the persona, the front, the mask, everything is going on because your instincts are telling you that's what you need to make it. At about 50, that's starting to fall off. Like it doesn't feel like it's protecting you anymore, and it has no point because probably at some point you're losing what you fought for. You know, what goes up has to come back down.
Uh-huh.
The laws of gravity and aging. And so you have to start befriending that and learning to, it does what mindfulness does. So when thoughts come in of rejection or humiliation or whatever, you have a wide enough basket to be able to hold all of it. And if you can hold all of that, and allow it to not, sidetrack you so you get even more ambitious because now it's time to let go of it, then wisdom comes in.
Uh-huh.
And wisdom and compassion. And once you have compassion for yourself, then you can give it to other people. But that only comes where you can start to let go of all that drop, make peace with that drive. You already did it. You don't need to build more identity.
Mm-hmm.
But in this culture, again, we're trained to yearn for our youth. You know, we can still do it. You know, we can still make it. Well, if you haven't made it by a certain point, I'd say let it go.
Yeah, that's the theory of it all from the book. But what's happening in your world? Because you were driven, you were very successful. And when, at the age of 50, you mentioned in the book, when the BBC offered you a game show over the very successful documentaries, you went, good luck. And that must have hurt you.
That hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that hurt. But I mean, in a way, accidentally, they did me a favor, because there's nothing sadder than some old celebrity dragging on, you know, and they put her on a game show where she has to eat her young, you know, or do a documentary about my gallbladder operation. So there's humiliation in holding on.
Yeah.
You know, if you had a peak, I remember Carrie Fisher once saying, somebody said, are you Carrie Fisher? And she went, I was.
Yeah, yeah.
So and you don't want to get bitter. You don't want to get bitter. So by kicking me out at that age, I could reinvent again. Mm. If you don't get kicked out, you can't reinvent. You have to obey each chapter in your life. So rather than hold on, I let it go. And boy, is that scary.
Yeah,
but then I ended up at Oxford. So if I didn't get kicked out of TV, I'd be an idiot.
Yeah. You mentioned self-compassion there. And reading your book, it strikes me that that is something that has only come to you late in life. And yes, I'm sure you've read all the books, and they all talk about, you know, self-compassion being the foundation for a good mental health. So why did it take you so long, Ruby Wax, to love yourself?
I wouldn't say I love myself.
Yes,
from certain angles, I'm really hot. Certain angles. My ankles are kicking. And then it goes downhill. Then it gets uphill. Then it goes downhill.
Yeah.
Then it's a travesty.
Yeah, but you were hard on yourself. Obviously, you know, fueled by your parents.
I asked my professor at Oxford, you know, and I do practice mindfulness.
Yeah.
Because it keeps me... I can be focused for much longer than most people can, because you're exercising a muscle. So you know how to pay attention. And also, when people are talking to me, I'm there with them instead of thinking about the sandwich I'm going to eat later.
Right.
What mindfulness does, it really helps you pay attention. And that's the golden chalice. But the whole thing about that is, what was I talking about?
You see, there you go. You said, there you go. You said, I'm here in the moment, and then you forgot where you were. Anyway.
I was here in the moment.
Yeah. No,
so why would I remember what you were talking about?
I was talking to you about I was talking to you about self-compassion. That's what I was talking about.
Oh, yeah. So let me just say, he said, I said, I don't like the C word. You know, it's too gooey, and that's why most of us don't do it. You know, sometimes very rich people have a charity where it's £2,000 for a fish egg. But, you know, then it's about... it's about their kudos. But I said to my professor, I don't really like talking about compassion. And he said, the very fact that you can sit and listen to your brain, which is a horror show most days, he said, that's self-compassion. Mm. If you can listen to yourself and not kick your own ass, because you're actually allowing the thoughts to go through, you're not getting carried away in stories. So the narcissism stops. That ego stops, and you go, okay, so now I hate myself, now I like myself, now just move on through, and eventually who you really are is not somebody who has FOMO or feels disgust or whatever. There's something much more profound that we all have, but we're in a world filled with weapons of mass distraction, so we don't usually get to it.
There's a chapter in the book, it's like your greatest hits from your TV career and all the brilliant, famous, odd, nasty people you, not all of them, but the highlights of the people you interviewed over the years. Bill Cosby's mentioned, Carrie Fisher, I think, Bette Midler, and Donald Trump, who's obviously in the news again.
One of my great friends.
I watched the clip in his private jet. That was aux, as the young people say. That was very aux, wasn't it?
Well, it was the worst interview I've ever done.
All right.
But television is, you know, can be, they can't distinguish. They just think, I'm being audacious. I was being a jerk. It wasn't a good interview. It didn't matter. It was Donald Trump, and he deserves no publicity at all.
Yeah.
I don't think we should breathe his name.
Okay, we'll move on. We move on. So of all the people you met, and it's a long list, who stood out for you?
Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I got on the tap shoes and made sure she loved me by the end of that interview. And she did. Mm. You know, and so my whole show was just worth becoming her friend for 35 years.
And she edited your memoir, as you said earlier.
And she edited my memoir, yeah. But she was a genius. Forget Star Wars, but her writing is superb.
Yeah. You were back on the telly in 2022 with Mel C and...
Oh, yeah, that was another travesty.
Oh, that was another travesty.
Yeah.
But you've got some oddball pitches over the years. So I mentioned that book earlier on. It was about being a human, you and a neuroscientist and a monk. And that caught the attention of some TV production company. And what was the pitch?
Oh, you cannot believe it. I'm doing a book and a show called How to Be Human with a Monk and a Neuroscientist.
Yeah.
They're as big as you can get. These are the boys that are, you know, that are the top of their game.
Mm.
So some, I can't make it as funny as when you read it in treatment form. They offered us to do a show called All Aboard the Coach,
yeah.
The something to coach. And we would pick up six mentally ill celebrities and put them on our bus. And there'd be funny things like we'd get a flat tire and the neuroscientists would have to change it. They put in some gags and then we took them around the world to get healed, right? So, but they said places like in Africa where they cut the throat of a chicken and then dance around it. You know, they went for the extremes. And imagine doing a show with a monk and a neuroscientist who really work in those fields and getting mentally ill people to get on a bus with you.
Oh, God.
And then they said, what would be really interesting if the crew were also mentally ill?
My word.
So let's picture that. Yeah. My cameraman has killed himself, so I have to take over the camera. I mean, on every level, that's so bad that it could be a great comedy.
Yeah, only if it was fiction. Ruby Wax, I'm not as well as I thought I was, which begs the question before we leave you. How are you now?
Dandy. I'm dandy. As you people say.
I don't say dandy. I've never said the word.
Something about crack.
Yes, I'm having the crack.
You guys do a lot of crack.
Yes. C-R-A-I-C as opposed to the other type. Yes.
Yeah.
So Ruby is coming to Ireland in October. And Everyman in Cork, Theatre Royal in Waterford, the Pavilion Theatre, the Machan in Belfast, Town Hall Theatre. You've loads of time to read the book and save up and get ready for that. Ruby, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today. And you can go and take that call from your daughter now.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Ruby.
Thanks
bye
for
now.
Talking.
Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.